Hello, and welcome to this webinar on MomsFightingAutism.com. I'm your moderator this evening, Chantal Cecile Kira. I'm a writer and speaker on autism spectrum disorders. My books are Autism Life Skills, Adolescence on the Autism Spectrum, and Autism Spectrum Disorders. My guest this evening is Darlene Hansen, who has been a speech and language pathologist for over 20 years, working with individuals with severe communication impairments. Her expertise is mostly in working with individuals who are nonverbal and use alternative modes of communication, as well as in the area of speech development for persons with severe motor apraxia as it relates to autism. Darlene worked in the public school setting as a school-based clinician and program specialist, taught university-level courses at Chapman University. She currently provides training on autism, full inclusion, creating a communicative environment, and facilitated communication. Her mission is to provide quality training and support to individuals with severe communication impairments so that their lives are enhanced by communication and that they will have a means of communication to actively participate in their lives and community. Welcome, Darlene.
Hi, thank you, Chantal.
Thank you so much for accepting to be on this MomsFightingAutism.com webinar. It's really an honor to have you on here. I should probably disclose to the people listening that you also oversee my son's program at school through a company for which you are the, I think, the communication director for, and I'm sure you'll tell us a bit more about that. But can you tell us a little bit about how you first became involved with people that had severe motor apraxia and more and other types of nonverbal behaviors?
Yes. I'll start with where I work, and then we can get that off the plate. I work in Whittier, California, which is just outside of Los Angeles, California, and we are a group called WAPITA, for lack of a better way to say it. And it's an adult agency that has recently taken on our communication department, and that is the department I'm a director of. And our focus as a communication department and as an agency is to provide services to individuals with developmental needs and autism, but provide them from a communicative basis. And so it fit nicely for my practice to move over and work with WAPITA because we both have this common mission. Let's see. When I was in, I can go all the way back to high school, but I've always been interested in the field of communication and communication disorders. When I started working professionally, I started working in a school system here in Whittier, which would be in the local Los Angeles area, and worked with our students with severe handicaps. Is what the program is classified as. And so a number of my clients and students were and are nonverbal or else very, very limited in their verbal communication. So that's always kind of been my emphasis. In the early 90s, when we started doing facilitated communication specifically, that was before autism had the motor components identified that it does now, we started using facilitation and knew that it worked with people when it did work because of the motor differences. So because there was no information on that need when it came to the population of autism specifically, we just started to learn about motor planning and motor disorders as much as we possibly could and started applying that to how people access augmentative communication. So I've been using those principles since then, and to facilitate communication has a completely different definition now, working-wise, than it did in the early 90s. Same foundation, but a different focus, I think it's safe to say. And so we're working towards getting people to type independently or communicate independently all the time, and that people are achieving it. So just motor development and motor planning seems to be a big part of what impedes people accessing augmentative communication and or their speech.
Uh-huh. Now, how can you explain a little bit more about what about motor planning and how that affects not just the ability to speak, but even just the ability to communicate by I don't know, grabbing icons off of a Velcro board or pointing to letters.
Yeah. For communication, excuse me, the motor system, well, the motor system specifically for a person with autism, when we look at that just in general, not each individual, but in general, we see that their system isn't integrated. So when we look at a person on the outside and we say, oh, he's a linear thinker, that actually looks like his neurological system as well. So you don't get the integrated, generalized kind of motor planning going on that you would expect in an individual. So that's why I think we teach people to maybe, you know, take pictures or do certain signs or anything, one kind of motor pattern, but it doesn't generalize to the language area. So we're working on generalizing that language area. The same thing happens with the speech. So some people have oral motor control to say automatic phrases or their favorite things, we call them, or their stereotypical phrases, but to actually engage in voluntary language processing, you don't get any responses at all. So that's the motor system affecting that as well. It can also go down to the sensory motor level where you don't have the tone in the oral area or the coordination in the oral area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is pretty recent that people have actually been looking at how the motor planning specifically affects being able to communicate other than just the speaking part. Is that correct? I think that we hear more about that now than we did in the past.
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. I mean, when we started doing facilitated communication specifically in the early 90s, you know, autism was still very much only a behavioral disorder, and no one really looked at the neurology of what was going on. So if you didn't talk, it was because you weren't, for lack of a better term, smart enough to talk. Now, with the current research that's coming out, there's a lot of research on motor planning difficulties, motor planning differences, what's going on neurologically with that. Most kids diagnosed nowadays will get OT, for example, occupational therapy. Again, in the early 90s, that was unheard of. It was very, very rarely was there justification or provision of that service. Now it would be irresponsible for people not to have that service in most cases. So there's a lot of information now about the motor difference when you're talking about somebody with autism, and it is affecting their means of communication.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because now also because of the Internet, there are a lot more people sharing information, and a lot of people who are typers, whether or not they need support or not, there's a lot more discussion on the Internet that I have seen about how their motor planning affects not only their ability to communicate, but also their behavior. And it all seems to be related.
Oh, yeah. The behaviors sometimes that we see, when we're talking about motor planning or motor abilities, we look at the automatic motor system versus the voluntary motor system, which we all have and use. It makes our systems efficient. So the example I often give is when you're learning to drive a car and you have to think about driving, and so you're thinking, should I step on the gas or should I step on the brake? You know, where do the keys go? Did I check my rearview mirror? All of that is cognitively planned out. Now, as you get your driver's license and you get some practice with it, that becomes automatic. You're not thinking about doing that. That's why sometimes we drive to the kids' elementary school instead of the grocery store, because we are not thinking about where we're going. We're just doing our automatic pattern of driving our kids to school. Those kinds of things happen. That makes our systems more efficient. But for a neurotypical person, you can call on that and switch over to voluntary. So you can say, I need to go to the grocery store instead of the elementary school, so I'm going to pay attention to where I'm going. Or you get a rental car, and you think about it first. You think, okay, do I need to know where the lights are and the windshield wipers are? So you've switched into voluntary mode there. people with autism have difficult time doing that a lot of the time. So you'll get conversations, for example, if it's a limited verbal person, about their favorite topic. And it might be dinosaurs, it might be trains, it might be the astronomy, any, you know, whatever their favorite thing is, but you can't get them to engage in a conversation on your own agenda because they can't switch over to that voluntary system sometimes. When you're stuck in that mode of, oh, I'm doing this, I'm doing my automatic thing, you could get behaviors because sometimes the people know they're stuck. They can't switch over unless we give them some kind of support to do that. So just that alone can create behaviors. Of course, not being able to communicate what you need creates behaviors oftentimes as well. And that's always what we've been thinking of. You know, behaviors and communication and part of a behavior plan has been around for a long time. But now we can help support that to happen for people. And sometimes I'm giving people an option either to say, I'm stuck right now. Help me get out of this, rather than just, I'm mad, okay? Mm-hmm. So when you have communication, those behaviors can go to another, the behavior problem solving can go to another level, and you can ask the persons and the individuals to do some of that problem solving with you rather than just labeling, I'm mad or I'm tired or I need a break. That doesn't always solve their problem.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to engage them in the problem solving part, but you need communication to do that with, and I think that's what all of us have as a goal.
So what I think I hear you saying is that sometimes in some individuals, of course, you know, the spectrum is a wide range of people. That's why it's called a spectrum. But for some individuals, instead of focusing so much on making a bad behavior go away, it'd be more about giving them an option to communicate so therefore they don't continually use that other behavior because, in fact, that other behavior might be a way that they're trying to communicate something.
Absolutely. Specifically in California, but I think in most of the United States, you have the behavior plans are supposed to be positive behavior plans nowadays, which is a good thing. And so you're supposed to be identifying your replacement behavior. But if you don't have, if you only have a person who can communicate at the most concrete level, then really all you have is a person identifying that they need a break, or that they're mad, or that they're happy. We can usually tell that. We can tell when a person needs a break. What would be nicer and what helps your behavior plans out and your behavior support out is when the person can tell you what they need from you. So what we end up with when we have a good communication system going for that person where they can be expressive, which is possible in many, many situations, is the person being a part of their behavior plan development. And you're saying to them, what can I do to help you with this behavior? I have a guy that has some stress over taking off his shirt. And so today we sat down and I did a social story, and he told me with his written language communication what each step of the process was going to be for him. And he and I were able to discuss what a better version of the end result would be than what he was choosing, or not choosing, but having happen. So we could get into his coping skills.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very important, and it is a big step forward.
Yeah, it is. It's going to be more important for the persons that continue to be nonverbal and yet are turning into adults and growing up. And
right.
They're getting more and more frustrated with their situations.
Right.
So.
And before we start going to the many questions that have been sent in, I wanted to ask you, because some of the questions refer to this, and also because people constantly bring this up at conferences that I present at, even though I'm not presenting about communication, but because of the fact that my son has a little bit of verbal but communicates by pointing to letters or typing. And so a lot of parents and also people in school districts are afraid to try other forms of communication other than verbal when the kids are little, because they assume that that is going to keep someone from using verbal communication. Would you like to discuss your professional opinion and expertise on that?
Well,
your opinion.
Right. The use of AAC, or that's what we call augmentative communication, alternate and augmentative communication, has been around for a long time, you know, 30, 40 years. And there's been research since that time on whether or not it's a good idea or a bad idea to use it for persons who seem to be having the potential to develop some speech. And the research has in the past and continues to support the fact that, no, AAC, using AAC does not make people stop talking. What we're seeing is it actually is enhancing and in promoting speech for many individuals. Not that that's a guarantee, but it can be used to do that and support that for some people. And the end result is you still have communication even if you're not talking. So I think that in a school system, for example, if we're looking at how our hours are spent that way, or even in a child's day, you know, you got to think about how many hours in the day are there and where are we going to devote our attention, of course. But and that doesn't have to be – what you decide today doesn't mean that that's it for life either. So if you want to support the use of the development of speech, that's a good thing. But if you don't have speech – it would be a very good idea, I think, and because of my experiences, I would support developing a use of an augmentative mode at the same time, and sometimes making that your priority first and then going back to the making speech your priority once you get communication happening. Because if you don't have communication, you're going to get behaviors.
Right. Right. Exactly. Okay, Darlene, would you like to, before we get started here on the questions, do you have a website that you would like to mention to people who are listening if they would like more information about you and also about WAPEDA?
Yes. My website is my name, and so it's www.darlene, D-A-R-L-E-N-E, Hanson, H-A-N-S-O-N.com. So it's darlenehanson.com. And on there I talk about communication. I have my email. People are welcome to email me questions. If I have something to offer you, I'll do that. And if I don't, I'll say I don't know what to do for that. but it's always open for discussion. I'm welcome those questions.
Okay, that's great. Okay, now I'm going to start with some questions here.
Okay.
Okay. So here's a question from Chris in Camarillo, California. My son is 3.5, and he is nonverbal. He just babbles and makes sounds, but no real words. He has been in speech therapy for 2 years, but his biggest challenge is imitation. Can a child start talking without first imitating? Do you have any tips on teaching imitation? And do you think he might benefit from oral motor exercises? Thank you.
Okay, so for Chris in Camarillo, I'm a strong supporter of oral motor therapy for people with autism. You would have to have your speech therapist look at the oral motor development. Again, some people don't have any tone. Some people just don't have the organization or the rhythm. Some people don't have the breath support to communicate and to do all the pieces that it takes. So if you are communicating, it takes breath support, it takes vocalization at your vocal cord level, and then it takes articulation at your oral area. All three of those things have to happen the right way at the right time. If you have a motor planning problem, not you personally made it for yourself, but your neurological system is disordered that way, that could be very difficult. So to get that all organized is primary in what you want to look at. And using oral motor approaches are perfect for that. Imitation, of course, is going to help, A, in practice, and B, in teaching. So once you get your little guy to imitate what you're saying, then you can help him practice what he's talking about. So that is key. I mean, he's 2, and so that's still young. I think that it's important to continue to ride that developmental train there and keep those therapies going. But also I think that it's going to be important to, and I think it should be acceptable, to augment some of his communicative needs. You know, and for a two-year-old, that could be just with the environment, you know, or a picture book of some sort. But getting that turn-taking going is really important. And so asking questions of labeling and functional questions are really important as well to his language development. And you can use materials in your environment or set up an augmented device for that, all the while working on his speech at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've had a few people send in questions about imitation, imitating speech. Here's one from Dr. Batul El-Hilo in Riyadh. And I'm sorry if I'm messing up people's names. You know, I have a difficult name myself, so please bear with me. Darlene, is there any program found to be effective in training ASD children to imitate speech? In other words, how do you get imitation going speech-wise? Do you have any tips on that?
Well, there are, again, any of the oral motor approaches are going to work. If you, but I think they work best, or they're going to work in most cases. They're going to work the best if I think, and I find, if I have the person communicating with me. So if it's an older individual and you've been trying oral motor approach and nothing's happening, it's not kicking in, it's not generalizing, then I tend to focus again on getting the augmented communication going, getting the expressive language going. Because what I find sometimes, or a lot of the time, is what's going on for the person when I'm asking them to imitate something is completely different from what would be standard protocol. So my best example was a girl that I work with here in California that we were trying to get her to just open her mouth and just drop her jaw was all we wanted her to do. So we were working on drop your jaw, drop your jaw. That came okay. Then we wanted to work on, okay, now we're going to have you stick out your tongue. And I'm presenting this as a speech person would with a model and asking her to imitate, and nothing's happening, nothing's happening. And I'm allowing processing time, and I'm watching her face for any slight movements, and nothing's happening. So finally, because she types, I was able to say, okay, so what happens when I ask you to open your mouth? And she says, tell me to drop my jaw first. So I said, okay, drop your jaw and stick out your tongue. And she did it. Now, that wasn't the thing I was thinking. That's not usually how it has to go. You know, if I stick out my tongue, she should stick out her tongue. But her information about what was going on with her body was key in that situation. And that kind of stuff happens a lot, especially for the older people. And by older, I'm saying, you know, teenagers and above. In that they can provide us with ideas. Some people will say, well, show me a picture instead of a word. Or some people will say, you know, don't look at me while I'm talking. All these different kinds of things happen. But they tell me those things through an augmentative mode. So then I can work on their speech.
Right.
The strategy that I use the most, although I'm not certified in it because I kind of do it my version, I think a strategy that is worth going and learning about or having available is prompt.
Okay.
And that's a speech therapy approach that you would get training on, and that's spelt just like we think. So it's PROMPT, and you can go find their website, prompt, I think it's .com, but you would be able to find it, prompt and speech therapy would come up. And that's a nice strategy to help with a cueing system that is helpful for people with severe motor planning problems and difficulties.
That's great. Again, from Dr. Batul Hilo in Riyadh, dear Darlene, thank you so much for providing this opportunity. Another question is, how can I be able to assist ASD children with technology and augmentative communication? How can they help, and how do you get them? Of course, those are a lot of questions, and we've already gone over a little bit about how they can help, but do you have any advice to someone who's living in Saudi Arabia?
Well, I don't know, except for the Internet is a wonderful thing, so probably anything is available if you just Google it and ask for them to ship it over. But I don't know specifically what's available in Saudi Arabia. But
how to assist some ASD children with technology and augmentative communication.
Well,
how early would you start children on technology and augmentative communication?
Well, augmentative communication is defined oftentimes as low-tech versus high-tech.
Okay.
So low-tech means it could be a picture system. It would be something that you could personally make. Okay? So
okay.
Your text system is a low-tech system. Just using photos of things in your environment, that's a low-tech system. And so you can start using those kinds of activities with the 2- and 3-year-old, of course. And that's considered augmentative communication. When you start making it their system, their way to communicate, then what you can do with either of those even, then it becomes more of a format for them to communicate. But you can actually augment their communication just environmentally and material-wise for little guys in preschool. We then can go into high-tech systems, which are more computer-based. And so, and there's a whole host of those out there in the industry, changes all the time. But on those systems, they oftentimes have pictures, words, or letters in them. They oftentimes will have voice output. So that's what you would want it to have. You would type in or push a button and it would say something for you. The quality of the speech is often dependent on the cost, so the more you pay, the better the quality is you get for the speech in most situations, and it requires somebody to program it. So that's a high-tech system. You can, when you're going to pick a system for somebody, it's not just, oh, I give them a device, you have to look at how can you access it. And so you want to look at your needs, that the person's communication needs. You know, does this person need to communicate about basic wants and needs? Do they need to communicate because they're in a 10th grade social studies class? Those are different, okay? Do they need to communicate in the community? That's different. So what are their skills? What are their needs in their environments? And you want to choose a piece of equipment that's useful right now, so the person can access it right now, but also has a little bit of room to grow in so that you can start exploring, okay, well, what if I change the design, or what if I add more vocabulary, or what if I had a dynamic display where they had to search for words, kind of like the internet searches for things. Could he do those kinds of things and learn to do that on this piece of equipment? But the end result is no one device usually works for every situation. So you want to pick something based on your current needs and then think about how you're going to build it out. Again, looking on the internet, there's companies. Dynavox is a big one here, Dynavox Technologies in the United States. Prinky-Romic is another one. And if you have questions about this and you can't figure out how to email them or Google them, feel free to email me. That's another big company. Toby, ATI, is another big one. Those are for the high tech. They have a range of things. And Enabling Devices is another one. So there's a bunch of people and companies that have a variety going from low tech to high tech systems available.
Yeah, and I wanted to comment on something from experience in the past with my son, is that you can have the best device that you think is going to be great with your son, but if it's so complicated that the staff can't use it, or if the staff haven't had or don't have time to, or whatever the politics are, have not had training on it, it's not going to become a communication device. Would you agree?
Yes, and so the cruel joke is oftentimes things end up in the closet.
Correct.
And that is because, if you pick a device that is computer-based for an adult who lives with their parents who maybe are elderly and goes to a adult agency where they don't have one-to-one service and you know, might be even they don't even have small group service, but they would have large group of service, that's going to be hard for people to organize so that he can communicate on that. So that's not necessarily a good choice for that situation. Sometimes you just have to acknowledge that I'm limiting his communication, but he's having communication all day long. That's better than saying, I got the fancy device, but nobody knows how to use it, and we've had it for a year. And it does take, for the more high-tech systems, it does take somebody committing to, I'm going to be the guy that learns this machine inside out and
right.
can help with anybody with the programming. Sometimes you have to pay for that service, and sometimes a team member will take it on, and that's just their thing, and it makes sense. But when it works out, that's how it works. It's because there's somebody on the team that knows and isn't afraid of the technology. The other thing to remember when you're talking about a piece of equipment that you buy from one of these companies, so, you know, mid to high-tech range, the companies are very, very useful. So if something doesn't work right, just call their tech department. The number's always on the back of the device, and they can walk you through things that if you're not very knowledgeable about computers, you would think, oh, I'm never going to understand what they're talking about. But they can walk you through it. And so a lot of times, even for me, people will say, oh, it hasn't been working for about 3 weeks. And then I get it, and I say, well, you got to press the reset button. You know, and so for 3 weeks, the guy didn't have communication. When the tech department on the phone would have told her, press the reset button, and then it would have worked. So use those phone numbers. That's why you pay a lot for those pieces of equipment.
Right. It's kind of like why I like Mac and not PC, because when I talk to Mac people, they answer me right away and I can figure out what they're telling me. But I didn't used to always get that service with the PC I had before. You know,
yeah,
not saying
fun.
That all PCs
yeah.
don't give you that good service, but it's the same kind of thing as the computer is to yourself, that communications advice should be for the person who is using it to communicate and also the team that's supporting them.
And you might have, I have a lot of people I work with type, for example. And so they might use a LiteWriter or a word processor. The new one that I like is the Fusion by Writer Learning. They have these devices, and they would use them in school or in their homes, but they're not going to carry them out in the community. LiteWriter they might. They're not going to carry them to a swimming pool. So you have to have a paper-based picture system as well for some shortcuts. So you're going to have a variety of communication going on, designs going on in a person's life. That's normal. That should be what happens.
That's kind of like people who have their BlackBerry and who have a laptop, and then who also have a regular big computer at home.
Yes.
You have all these different modalities to get the same job done,
yep.
basically.
That's right.
Now, there have been quite a few questions here, lots of really good questions here, that have to do with echolalia. So I am going to read a couple of those, and then you can address it. So, for example, Izelle in New York, I would like to know how I can increase my daughter's communication. She talks, but she's not able to have a conversation. I also need suggestion on how to stop the echolalia. Sarah Muzapapa from Reading, Pennsylvania. My son recently turned 3, and he can speak well when he is repeating a book. His spontaneous speech is limited, and he tends to be somewhat echolalic. How can I help him turn his echolalic speech into spontaneous speech? And the last one is from Nareen in Armenia. Could ABA program, especially the Screech trial, help autistic children with their speaking programs? For example, when children has echolalia, is it possible to create or develop spontaneous speech?
Okay, those are good. I think echolalia fits under the automatic. And so when I talked about the automatic motor planning, you're just giving it back. It's automatic. I have something to say. Or I like listening to this storyline from Lion King. It's not voluntary. It's not thought out process. So what you really want to focus on is getting the person to take turns. Scenario that works a lot of the time is, because we get the example of, oh, if I give choices, he always picks the last one. And so do you want spaghetti or a sandwich? Sandwich. Do you want a sandwich or spaghetti? Spaghetti. Okay, and that's how we double check them, is by rearranging the order, but we always get the last one. What can if you have a person who you're working through their motor planning problems while working on their communication, you can say, okay, I wanted to know what you wanted for dinner. So I'm asking if you want a sandwich or spaghetti. So what do you want for dinner? Now the last thing I've said is dinner. Okay, and the person can oftentimes process that through. If you practice, you know, saying wait, think about it, what's your answer, process through and get to their a real answer, because you're not getting that automatic anymore. You're not just going for that automatic. The processing system of your motor system is supposed to work, and I'll try and do this on the phone. You know, in talking, it's better in visual. But all of our motor processing goes through this ideation of idea, plan, and execute. So idea's on the top. So you think of what you're going to do or say. Your body then neurologically plans it out, and then it happens. That's the execution. For people with motor planning differences, that sequence might be disrupted. So when you get the echolalia, you're just getting the execution. You're not getting the ideation part. You're not getting the idea, the neurological planning, and then the execution. So if you can slow that process down, sometimes it's just a matter of saying wait, because sometimes kids will not only have echolalia in their speech, but they'll have it in picture picking. So oftentimes I get kids who they've been doing PECs, but now they just give you back everything. They don't discriminate between the two or four choices. So they just touch them all or give them all. Well, they're not planning out through idea, plan, execute. So if I just say, put your hands in your lap, think of the question. How do kids get to school in the morning? Look at your choices. Now, pick the one you want. Then perhaps they'll pick bus. I'm coaching them to let that idea, plan, execute happen. And you can do the same thing with speech by slowing down. Hang on, listen to your choices. Here you go. Now, if they're just repeating themselves over and over again, you might use a visual mode to kind of break that up. And so you could write to them. You could have them pick things through written language or visual language of pictures. Either way, it doesn't matter, whatever your guy can do. And have them do the visual first and then label it, because you've got to get out of that automatic. In regards to the ABA question that Maureen had, you know, ABA programs often include vocal or verbal imitation. You would need, in my opinion, in my bias, because I'm a speech and language person, is that you would need to have a speech and language person guiding that process. It's not just say these little words and then say these bigger words and then say is verbing. That's not the process of language development. So you want to have, I mean, speech and language people use ABA in their teaching, so that's not a problem. But you do want to have your speech and language person guiding the process of language development, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
So turn-taking is very important when looking at the echolalia. You want to get the turn-taking, and the turn-taking, you're going to be able to see it when you see the person's slowing down and thinking through what is their real answer.
And does sometimes echolalia, and I'm thinking more about people like Temple Grandin, because Temple Grandin always talks about how she was echolalic when she was little, and if you have someone who is echolalic, also listening to what they're saying, if they're saying appropriate things, in other words, echolalia that is repeated a long time afterwards, not immediately, but used in a correct situation, that sometimes that's something that you can work from, which is different from the kind of echolalia that you're talking about, is it not?
Right. And, well, there's different. There's meaningful echolalia and there's non-meaningful echolalia. And
okay.
So the meaningful, some people are very resourceful. And, like, I have had a student that I worked with where he would only sing, like, tunes that he heard on TV and Nickelodeon, which is a station here in the United States, he would pull those little limericks that he would have whether you play with in his head and verbally, and use them very meaningfully. So Blue's Clues is a show that he liked, and they're in part of that cartoon, that kids show, it'll say, oh, I have an idea. And when he wanted the activity to change, he would say, I have an idea, just like they did on Blue's Clues. Well, that was meaningful. So if you kind of knew that about him, then you could listen to all the little songs and limericks that were coming out, and actually he used those communicatively really well. He's very resourceful. So that's a meaningful echolalia. Then there's the non-meaningful echolalia, which is just jibber-jabber.
You're wanting to hear it, or like you, or the whole explanation.
Stimming on the words, or stimming on the scene of a movie. And some people are doing that all the time, and yet they're not saying anything that makes any sense to the situation at all. Sometimes you can't even understand it. Now, some people, there's a guy here in New York, Jamie Burke, and he goes to Syracuse University, and he'll say things like, he'll quote lines from the Fantasia movies. And he can do that all the while working on his high school or now college level papers.
Right.
You know, and he's talking about Mickey Mouse from Fantasia. So that's not meaningful. That's just turned on, and it's like another, again, the system's not integrated. So in actuality, sometimes people are doing two things at once. Not that it's healthy or efficient, but it is what's happening.
Right. Here's a question from Deanna Goodson-Greer in South Carolina. My son is almost 4, has mild autism, and he has a severe language disorder. His expressive is much lower than his receptive. What are some things we can do at home to get him where he needs to be? Does this go along as well with the auditory processing issues?
I'm not going to diagnose over the phone here, but
yeah,
it probably does have auditory processing written all over it. And so that's really common, though, where kids will be understanding, parents especially will know, hey, he understands everything I'm talking about. I can tell by the way he responds, his timing, his ability to pull things out later on, that kind of thing will happen. But he can't answer a question. He can't put words together to make a sentence. Those kinds of things will be happening. The same thing will often happen in reading, where people will say, he can read a textbook at grade level, but he can't answer the questions. Okay, so it's the flip way. But it's the same problem. And that's the processing. So you want, in Deanna's case, you want to really focus on getting his expressive language to increase. You can try augmentative communication in tandem with trying traditional, if he has some speech, in tandem with traditional, you know, expanding your language and your vocabulary kind of strategies. But don't be afraid of the augmentative communication. Neurologically, people are wired to talk with their hands. And so as we teach them to use augmentative with their hands, there is a residual to the area of speech.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Bonnie Sayers in Los Angeles. My nonverbal son is in sixth grade special education classroom with an aide. He has not had speech since fourth grade due to a shortage in L.A. His IEP is on May 20th. I bought a Go Talk 9 Plus a year ago for him. Any ideas for a goal to incorporate speech into his day? At the CSUN Tech Expo in March at LAX airports, I was impressed with the Smart Talk by AMDI that has software, so not restricted with levels, and can have words, voice, and pictures. It is under $800 and looks worth it. Do you have any experience with it?
I don't have any experience with that specific piece of software. Did Bonnie say that her son doesn't have any expressive language? Did she mention that, or he just bought the Go Talk?
She says he's nonverbal.
She did, okay. So, I mean, the Go Talk 9 can be very, very useful. Again, that's for you guys that don't know what it is, it's an augmentative communication device considered low-tech. But you can put in there multiple pages, we call it, and so you can actually save up different pages. So even though it only has 9 boxes, you can, I think it's, I'm trying to use my memory, but I think there's 7 levels. I'm not positive, you'd have to check. But by the levels, it means that you could have, if there were 7 levels, you could have 7 boards. Are you there? Mm-hmm. Okay. Just
yes, and how many pictures are on each board?
So for the Go Talk 9, there's 9. There's a Go
Talk. Oh, I see.
So there's different levels of Go Talks. Now, the catch is that we oftentimes, when we give a communication device like the Go Talk or the Tech Talk or any of those kind of low-tech area devices, we tend to put in things that we think are reinforcing. So we'll put in high. We'll put in high. Well, if a person can shake your hand or touches you on the shoulder or goes to you for a kiss, then he already said hi. So now you've wasted a box for hi. We only have 9, so you don't want to waste any. We put in thank you. Well, that's just of course it's nice to teach thank you, but if you only have 9 things to say, is that one really the biggest deal? We put in I want a drink. Well, again, that's okay if you have the availability to have a board that is just for foods, for example, or, you know, lunchtime. But if that's taking up a spot and there's not that many times in the day where you're going to get to use it, then that might not be the best choice. So you want to create a board or a display that allows more communicative opportunities. And kind of my pet peeve in the past couple of years right now has been that when we do augmented communication, especially at the low-tech end, or even at the beginning end, the beginning part of learning to access augmented communication, we tend to interview people. And we do that as the communication partner. And so we tend to say, what did you do last night? And then they say, ate dinner. And you say, what did you eat? And they say, pizza. Where did you go for the pizza? And they say, mom. And so it's an interview. That's not how people talk. So all you're going to get is a single word answer. And you're not going to have a lot of opportunity. Whereas if you can think of a dialogue that you would have with your person, put in some comments, put in some questions. That's a great idea. Cool. What, you know, if you're talking about an 8-year-old, listen to what the 8-year-olds say. If you're talking about a high school student in California, you would say, that's sick, which is a good thing. But you want to put those kind of comments in the display because you're going to get more mileage out of that. The person's going to be able to take a turn more often than if their board only says, hi, thank you, I need a drink, and I'm happy, or I need a break.
Right.
Those are all important things. I'm not saying they're not important, but if that's all you're going to get to talk about, then we can't be surprised when we sit in a meeting and we say, you know what, he doesn't really use it that much.
Right.
You know, if a person just kept saying hi, 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 then we'd write a goal that he needs to stop saying hi so much. Right?
Right.
So you really have to think through what's the vocabulary, and you might not get it right the first time, but, you know, if you think along the lines of what would I be saying right here, what do most of the kids say? If you're a middle school boy, it's one-liners from movies. You know, that's how they talk. So those might be more interactive where you can get more turns than the functional daily living stuff. Now, you'd want to have that available, but maybe not taking up all the spaces on the display.
Right. Bonnie also asked, do you have any tips on how to work on speech skills over the summer when school is off for so many weeks?
Well, I think, well, that Bonnie's asking, and I guess is a hard thing, because what I wanted to say for everybody who does have a speech person would be to get homework from your speech person. But since Bonnie's already said she doesn't have a speech person, then I guess that's a problem. But the best scenario is to get goals and exercises and activities from your speech person before summer starts. Have them give you some ideas on what they're doing in therapy and such. If you don't have a speech person, then I guess it's an ongoing problem. What should I be working on?
Yeah, are there places on, I know it's so individual, so it's hard to give a blanket answer, but are there places on the internet where someone could go look and say, well, gee, I have this kind of a kid, maybe I could do these things to help them out a little bit, or just to help give parents some ideas?
I don't know if there's any protocols that are outlined on the internet. I can't think of any off the top of my head, and I've never researched it. So that could be an idea. If you go to, I'm going to write it out right here. I think it's Gail Vantenhaven. I'm going to write it out. She's in Florida, and she's an augmentative communication person. And her name is G-A-I-L, and her last name is Vantenhaven, I think, V-A-N-T-E-N-H-A-V-E-N. If you go to my website, I might have a resource listed for her. She has a list of core vocabulary on her website for augmentative communication users that I really like, and as a kind of a direction, because what that list is generated from is what are the most useful communication vocabulary for all of us, as opposed to like a Dolch reading list where you get is and ba and it. Those aren't really communicatively high intent. But Gail has a list on her website that are words and vocabulary that just reminds you of, gosh, you got to be able to say thank you. You got to be able to say, how are you? You got to be able to say today or yesterday or tomorrow to mark time. And you can kind of go through there and see what would be most important for your child, given his age and environment that he goes in, and practice those either through speech or through visual modes, you know, with the augmentative stuff. That would be good.
Okay, that sounds good. Here's a question. Oh, gosh, I lost it here. I was looking at this question. Oh, here. Kathleen from Rochester. I know that some older children and adults have been able to use a picture book or small cards to communicate with others. At what age do you begin to introduce these forms of communication? And how successful are elementary-age children using them to communicate when they are not in school? So I guess less structured environments.
Well, if that's how you focus it, then they can be very successful. Again, because with the autism especially, the skills oftentimes don't generalize. You're going to have to teach them in the direct environment, the structured environment, plus in the natural environments. But you know, preschoolers can use augmentative communication with picture-based as well as adults. So it's never too early or too late to introduce picture systems to a person if you don't have any mode of communication. I'm going to kind of digress here because I want to make sure I say this, but in the field of augmentative communication, the only thing that really allows you to be a creative, expressive person is your alphabet. You know, and what symbol system your language uses depends on where you live. In the United States, we've got 26 letters. So that's the only way a person can really express themselves, because everything else is predictable. Someone set it up. Someone said you needed that vocabulary. If you don't need that vocabulary, or if you need something different, if you don't have an alphabet, you can't say so, okay? So you need to be able to access literacy. So you want to have goals for little guys especially that are around developing literacy skills. And it's very possible that your person with autism may already have literacy or can develop literacy skills that you can then put into communication. So the age of the person doesn't matter. It's just there's no window of opportunity. You're not missing that window. And little kids understand pictures, but a lot of little kids understand written words too. For them, they're just memorizing it just like they do the picture.
Right.
So cat always is C-A-T. And it's that round circle with the triangles on top and whiskers.
That's right.
I just memorized that. So, but if you do memorize that, if I could teach you that, gosh, I know C-A-T is cat. So If I ask you to point to cat, you do. But how about if I say, spell cat? Oh, you do. How about if I say, what animal says meow? And you spell cat. Well, now we're into communication.
Right.
So there's never, I don't think of there as being a window of opportunity for either speech or for communication. Is it better for early intervention? Absolutely. But just because
right.
you've maxed out and everybody else already developed their speech by the time you're 8 does not mean you're not going to develop your speech when you're 35.
Exactly. And I was going to get to about teaching to type because I have a few of those questions here. In fact, Rachel in Warrington, how do you teach a child to type who does not read? But before you get into that, I want to absolutely agree with Darlene on this. As a parent, not as a speech and language pathologist, as a parent of a child, well, he's not a child anymore, he's a young adult, but who has some speech, and I used, and also speech therapists used a variety of methods to get Jeremy to communicate through the years. I mean, we did discrete trial to get him to make sounds. We did a lot of oral motor exercises. We did pecs. We did a lot of different things that always, each step helped him, but nothing really, there is, I want to say right now, there's no magic pill and no magic bullet, and anything you're hearing tonight is work,
okay?
But that's just the way it is. It's not going to be something you're going to give him in the morning, and that's it. It's work.
Yeah.
And now my son Jeremy, who's 20, he's, you know, he still needs to learn a lot more skills, but he does have a way of communicating, and it took him a long time to learn to point to letters, but there is that window of opportunity never does close, and the sooner you can get some communication in, the better, because obviously everyone needs to communicate, but that's the thing I want to say to everybody. I totally agree with what Darlene's saying. There's never, never a time to stop teaching someone to communicate.
That's right. And especially since, I mean, if you're talking about little kids, now we know more about the autism neurologically.
Right.
So we can plug in therapies that apply that to the neurological makeup of your person. But if you're an adult, I mean, if you're 20, 30 years old, you didn't have that information. Your family didn't have that information when you were little about the neurological makeup because it's too new. So it's not too late to now start applying it. It still applies to you. You still are a guy with autism. So if we start applying it to them then and how we're serving those persons, sometimes it can happen. I mean, sometimes people don't develop speech, but they develop communication, you know. And sometimes developing augmented communication skills leads to using your speech. So that can be helpful. Now, on a side note here real quick, Chantal, while you were talking, I went to my website, and I do have Gail on my resource link. So if you go to my website, Gail Van Tatenhove is listed, and you can get the core vocabulary list from there.
Because somebody just sent me the link in over the Internet, and it's V as in Victory, A, N as in Nancy, T as in Thomas, A, T as in Thomas, E, N as in Nancy, H, O, V as in Victory, E, .com.
Right.
/files/lovemedo-u128.pdf. But other than that, it's probably easier to go to Darlene's.
Well, I just have her listed. I mean, you can, you know, yeah, it's just
right.
kind of getting to the core vocabulary list.
Right.
It's a free download
right.
for you.
But anyway, do you have any tips to people on how to teach typing?
Okay. So when Rachel says how old is her person?
It doesn't say. It says child. But I have also adults who have written in and said, how do you teach typing?
Okay. So sometimes if your motor system's not engaging in the right way, in the efficient way, so you don't have access that often to your voluntary system. You might not be able to initiate. You might not be able to inhibit. You might not be able to sequence movements. Then you're going to look like you don't know things because your body doesn't show you that you know things. And sometimes that thing that we don't think you know is reading. So a number of people, that's how I spend most of my time because that's why people come to me. So most of my clients were working on using literacy to communicate. Many of my clients, especially the older persons, we did not know that they have literacy. Okay? Now, sometimes for the kids, we'll say, oh, they like words, or they like books, or he takes those puzzle pieces and he spells out Thomas the Tank Engine names. Well, that might not be reading the book as in turning the pages, but you can use that if you start teaching. This is how you can communicate. And if you have those signs of literacy, or if we assess that you do have literacy, then you can start using the typing part. Now, for the person with a movement disorder, I would start off just by putting the word processor or the letterboard in front of them and seeing if they can communicate. Can they answer a question? Can they spell their name? Can they spell the name of the street they live on? Can they spell the word milk? You know, anything that's pretty familiar in their environment. If they can, then great. Now just ask a better question. Also on my website, I have a download for a language ladder. And the language ladder kind of helps you think of better questions. And it moves you through predictable questions to conversational questions and activities. And it's my adaptation from Rosemary Crossley in Australia. She developed the language ladder for us. So the person, a lot of times people do read, I mean, in the sense that they know what words are. Again, it's not reading necessarily, although some do, the way you and I read with the tracking and the social content. That's not what I'm talking about. But if you can use literacy, if you have literacy, we can use it to communicate. So if I try it out and you do it on your own, I just had to ask a better question, then that's a good thing. Sometimes, though, I have to give you some support. The support that I use comes from the theory of facilitated communication training. There's Soma, who I can't say her last name, but you might be able to, Chantal.
No, I can't. I know her very well, but I can't still.
And she's at the Halo Foundation, and she uses rapid prompt method, which also right. develops literacy or uses literacy skills for you.
My son learned
right.
Point to letters.
And then Portia Iverson has the informative pointing method. So more and more we're talking about accessing literacy. For me, when I do facilitated communication training, and those of us that do it, we're looking at supporting your motor system to move through that ideation, that idea, plan, execute more efficiently. So I'm going to give resistance, actually, which I definitely can't explain over the telephone other than to label it, resistance to your movement. It's kind of like arm wrestling, okay? So as you go for a letter, I'm going, or a word or a picture, whatever the symbol is that you don't do yet, there is a symbol hierarchy, then I'm going to give you some resistance to your movement, and I'm going to let you go wherever you go. If you get it right, great. If you don't get it right, I'm going to either back up on the language, symbol hierarchy. So if I was using words, I might use pictures. Or if I was using letters, I might use words. And I'm going to do a little bit of an assessment there. But I'm giving some physical support. I'm also spending a whole lot of time looking at how your body's organizing itself. Can you sit up in a chair? When I say point to something, does anything even move? Or do I have to say, come on, move your arm, point, make it move? Then you're not initiating. If you're slouched and have very bad posture, then you don't have tone in your whole body, never mind in your hand and your arm. So you're not going to probably move forward to the icon, whether it be picture, word, or letter. So first I have to accommodate that. Another useful tip that helps a lot of people is to present the display on a slant. And so we use slant boards an awful lot because aerodynamically you can move in a better fashion than up and down. Plus you can see more clearly. Your visual perceptual is more organized when it's in front of you rather than on a flat surface for most people. So we do that. And so I'm giving that physical support. Sometimes I'm giving a rhythm. So you go for the letter or the word, and I pull you back. And I might pull you back all the way to your body. But I do the pullback, again, with that continuous resistance. That's the part I can't show you over the phone. If you think of arm wrestling, that could help. Now, Soma uses more of the visual system, I believe, to engage your whole system. But for me, I'm looking at the proprioceptive system and how's that organizing itself.
I don't know how Soma does it now, but when she was giving lessons to Jeremy a few years ago, she was still doing I don't know how to actually describe this, except she was also doing, it wasn't resistive, but she would push on the muscles. It's sort of like giving a proprioceptive
tapping kind of thing.
Right, kind of tapping.
Yes. Yeah.
And the other thing that she did, which was really good for my son, was that what she would do is she never assumed that Jeremy knew anything because she didn't know him to begin with, but she would, if he was twiddling with something or playing with something or looking at a particular book, she would start right away talking about what it was that he was looking at. And then start asking him questions about pieces of information she gave him about what he was looking at. So, which for my son was very important because of his motivation. He had very low motivation in terms of, because of his motor aspect being so difficult to go past, he needed to be really motivated to get there.
Right.
But every person's different, but it's just interesting to know that there are so many different ways out there to get to the same result.
Right, right. And so depending on where you live, I know that the Facilitate Communication Institute is in Syracuse, and a number of the trainers have been traveling all over the world. They were in Sri Lanka. People are oftentimes in Europe, and there's a good body of people that do communicate this way in England and in Italy and Germany and other places as well. I think they might actually be there now in Japan. I think Saudi Arabia, Marilyn Chadwick was there, I believe, last year. Israel. So, there are people that come around, and if you wanted to know who was coming to your neighborhood, you can either go to the Facilitate Communication Institute website, or you can email me, and I'll try and find out for you. And then, of course, I know that Soma travels, and I know that Portia and an OT named Heather Claire travel around the United States as well. So
I have not heard of the informative pointing method. Did you want to speak a little bit about that?
Well, Portia actually has a hand manual kind of thing that you can download, just like Soma has her handbook that you can purchase, or manual. But the informative pointing method is point learning. It goes through steps to teach people how to point. The other thing that's nice that Portia Iverson has, I think, is on her website, which is strangesun.com. That's her book, Strange Sun. On her website, she has people who will upload video of them working with their persons, so you can get some visuals too. And that's just an opportunity. It's just a community that does that. It's not meant to be a teaching manual as far as the video goes. But it is a nice resource for people.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to see some visuals and get some ideas, I would say go to the strangesun.com website and check out what Portia's got there. I think that Soma has on her website, if you sign up, I think you can access some video. I'm not sure. And I don't have any video on my website because I'm not that
technical. But you're too busy.
The informative pointing method is another method or another protocol, I guess, really. We're all working towards the same goal that you can use to teach a person to type.
Good. I did want to mention something in speaking about literacy, but one thing that's really, really important to remember is that just because your child is not communicating does not mean that they're not listening and hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of reading over the years to your child, like
most people read to their neurotypical children is really a good thing to do, because that's all that over the years of then hearing people speak and hearing stories read to them, just and looking at books with them, really helps in all this. Don't you agree, Darlene?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I kind of liken it to, and there's no research on this, it's just a Darlene-ism. But, you know, if you have an auditory learner, so, and a speaker for your three-year-old and your four-year-old, and you got a neurotypical child, and he's growing up and you want to teach him new vocabulary, you just say it. And he gets it, right? And then he kind of plays with it and you shape it and you say, oh, no, that's, you know, that's not grandma, that's Aunt Claire. You shape it as it's occurring. And you don't expect that to take a lot of time. You just do it. And surprisingly enough, if you think about it, they do it too. So they learn from that experience. Their language, their primary language is auditory. And their speech, their oral motor system, it works, okay? If your primary language is not, sometimes they are strong in auditory, but a lot of times they're equally or only strong in the visual mode. So if the visual mode is either your primary mode or the most available mode for you, then maybe it doesn't take that long to learn visually either, because that's your mode of communication. That's your input, your mode of input. So when I see the word hamburger on the McDonald's sign with the picture, I got it. Just like the little guy who's learning to talk learns to say hamburger. Okay? So if that is true, I don't know, you know, there's no research to say it's true that I know of, but it makes good sense to me. If that's your primary mode of input, and we can teach you to use that for your output, it's not going to take a long time to learn to use your literacy, because you just do that really quickly. So when a person reads a book and they're sitting there with you and, you know, they're running their finger along it, you got it. I don't have to have it read to me a whole bunch of times, because that's what I do. I learn visually. Make sense?
That makes sense. And we've got a lot more questions here, so I'm going to move along. Shelley in Los Angeles says, hi, Darlene. When using FC, facilitated communication, how do you overcome the challenge of peripheral parties' doubtfulness?
Who says this?
This is Shelley.
Shelley.
In Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles. Okay. So how do you overcome everybody doubting? That's what she's asking?
Yes, correct.
Right. Well, people doubt when you have to give full support. And by full support means if you're holding the person's hand or wrist, making their finger point, using the forearm, you're going to have doubters because it looks weird. And it does. So the best thing to do is quickly establish some goals for independence. And usually if you organize the person using the support, but making your goal independent, you could get them to do like a multiple choice question without any touch, choice of four. Now, if a person can learn to do that, to answer multiple choice questions of four choices, without any touch, then he's learned to do that activity. So in theory, you should be able to give him grade level questions. You know, if he's preschooler, preschool questions. If he's an adult, adult questions. But he can access that kind of communication. That's what Soma's doing with the rapid prompt method. You might still have a doubter, but you also have a response in that, well, this is what he does. How did he learn how to do that? You know, people will say, well, how long does it take to convince somebody that this is real? And any one of us who do specifically facilitate communication, and probably the other strategies as well, will say, we personally have never, ever convinced anybody that this is real. It's always the user.
Only the user, exactly.
Only the user. And so if I can't, as a trainer, organize the team to understand what I'm talking about so that that person can communicate with them, then I'm not doing my job. And I'm not teaching them to communicate. Because I can't have hundreds of people with autism living with me, but so that I can be their communication partners. So we really, really have to focus on making a strategy and making it appropriate for that individual, everybody's different, to communicate and convince, I guess I'd say, their persons on their team that they're doing it and that they're communicating and that they can be taught to do this mode of communication, whether it be choices or letter boards or word boards or picture boards, whatever, to communicate more efficiently. That's what we have to set up, and that's how we have to focus our time. Now, are there people that are never going to be convinced? Yes. And I've met them. Not all of them, I hope. Or I guess I would hope I had, but unfortunately I haven't. And so people come up all the time that I'm not going to fit in their box. And the individual that I'm supporting is not going to fit in their box. So that I just have to find a better group of people to hang out with, I guess.
You know, it's very funny because I've had my fights over the years with the school districts. I've filed for due process twice, and I have to say I don't file over things like number of hours. I mean, they're usually, you know, really can't cross the line on this one, very big issues. And so when it came time, when I was at home working with Jeremy with the RPM and people communicating with him like this, I thought, you know, I'm not even going to go to school with this.
Right.
I thought, I don't have the energy for this. But when Jeremy started high school, the teacher came for a home visit. And I had just come in with having filed a fair hearing. So I was not coming in like with the with the chocolate chip cookies, and I was very nice and everything. But I thought, oh my gosh, what a reputation I have coming in here. This, you know, and I'm a nice person.
Yeah.
But this teacher came to the house, and she said, oh, I've heard you've been doing some stuff at home, and so I just showed her what Jeremy is doing. Besides, and what I did is I had bought like Summer Bridges books because I'm not a teacher naturally,
mm-hmm.
And Summer Bridges books are like the books that you buy. That are between grades. So when your neurotypical child is between fourth and fifth grade or fifth and sixth grade and you don't want them to forget during the summer, you buy these books.
Right.
So that's how I got ideas of things to talk about with Jeremy that were more academic, because he really was showing and saying he wanted to do math, and I'm just not a very good math person. So these books kind of helped me. And so I just did some of that besides showing her the chores he did at home and, you know, that kind of stuff. And a couple weeks later, she invited me to the classroom, and she said, you know, I've tried a few things that I saw you do with Jeremy, and I want you to train us here at school for how you got Jeremy. And so it wasn't me asking the school. It was the Jeremy convinced them.
Yeah.
And based on that, they – of course it could have gone faster maybe if I'd, like, pushed a little more or whatever, but I thought, you know what, this is the best way for it to happen. And Jeremy convinced them. And to this day, it's Jeremy that convinces other people.
Absolutely.
And maybe I'm really, really lucky that I fell in with the right people, but it is much more powerful when it is the individual with autism that is asking or showing than the parent. And I think that's why self-advocacy is such an important aspect, and self-advocacy skills are things we need to be teaching our guys at school.
Absolutely. And I think on that note, too, that's a nice opportunity for me to remind people that, you know, I live and work in Whittier, and California. And in Whittier, California is the largest community that uses facilitated communication in the country. And so it's just part of how we do things. I mean, you know, we're maxed out on support and we don't have any money just like everybody else, but we've been doing it for a long time. I don't want people to move to Whittier. But so I better put that.
Don't worry, I'm staying in San Diego.
Okay, yeah, San Diego's great too. But anyways, the thing is, so in most communities, it's a family that's going to need to figure this out, figure out this augmented communication. If you're going to go especially into literacy for your child, and if you think that's going to be a leap, then you need to figure that out at home first and get your person very good at it. Because if you have a person, I don't know if people know of Sue Rubin, but she's an adult who goes to Whittier College now, and she has a movie called Autism is a World that is not about facilitated communication, but she uses typing to communicate. And she types without any physical touch now, but she does still have to have a trained communication partner with her. And so in this film, you can kind of see Sue typing and such. But if you think that that video, which I do recommend to people, is going to convince your school district that your guy is another Sue Rubin, that's just not going to happen. You have to develop all the, you have to work through all the kinks. What makes it work? He can only sit down and do it for 5 minutes. He has to have you asking grade level questions. You can't ask basic questions. Whatever the little quirks are about your person, if you can figure that out at home first, then go to the school system, because 9 times out of 10, they're going to think you're odd for considering such a thing. And you don't want them trying to figure it out, because they think it's odd in the first place. They don't know anything about it, right? And so they're not going to be able to figure it out. So if you figure out and work through all the quirks first at home, then you can go in and say, well, no, all you have to do is give him 4 choices and put his hands in his lap before he answers the question. And so you give the question, you tell him to look at the display, and then you touch his elbow, and he goes. Now you know what to tell them to do. Then they can get on board. It's too much to think, they don't know what I'm talking about, I want them to learn it, and I want them to learn it on my kid, who might be pretty challenging. That probably isn't going to be very successful.
Right.
So home first is my suggestion.
Right. I told you guys we were going to talk about things that meant a lot of work.
Yeah.
No matter still. But you know what? There's always benefits to the work.
Yes.
Okay. There are a few people who have written in asking again for your name and to spell out your name so they can go to your website, because they've come in later on.
Okay. So my name is Darlene Hansen, and that's D as in Darlene, A-R-L-E, N as in Nancy, E, H, A, N as in Nancy, S as in Sam, O, N as in Nancy, .com. DarleneHanson.com.
Okay, great. Here's a question from Jessica Evans in Crawfordville. Hi, Darlene. My son Wesley is a 17-year-old autistic and has been nonverbal since he was 2 years old. He recently tried a GoTalk 9 but was only confused with using it, so we have gone back to using pictures in his wallet. We usually know what he is wanting or needing because we see him every day. What is the best way to get him to use pictures in everyday life outside of school? He really didn't receive speech services, and I thought he should have, but now I guess that is water under the bridge. He is almost grown. Is there any possibility that we can facilitate speech from him, or what is your best advice for us?
Well, it doesn't sound like you've maxed out on his augmented communication yet. So if he can, you know, he prefers to use the pictures in the wallet, I think, is what she's saying, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So how many pictures can he use? You know, can you ask better questions? Again, if you just make up a wallet that only describes your basic wants and needs, then that's all he can talk about. But if he can understand pictures as a symbol, then why can't you make up pictures that describe the universe and, you know, has all the planets? Well, that could be his communication board. You want him to engage in some thinking and some turn-taking, because otherwise they're not motivated to take a turn, because all we ever ask him is what he wants to eat. And he's not too old or too young to work on it that way. So if you understand, I think I'm going to tell you guys just over the phone here the symbol hierarchy. So write this down. It starts with, the symbol hierarchy starts at the most concrete level. So the most concrete is objects. Then it moves up. And so then you have photos. Then you have line drawings. Then you have, and you could have those color or black and white on either level. Color, of course, is more information than black and white. But then you go to written words. Then you go to letters. And then you go to speech. And in actuality, speech and sign language are at the higher end together, because they're both very motorically involved. So if your guy can do line drawings in his wallet, then he's a line drawing guy. Now then you look at what's the size of the display. Is it 6 pictures? Is it 4 pictures? Is it 2? How many can he handle? Now you have the size of the display. You can put whatever vocabulary you want in there. And you should change it up not in his wallet because he's used to using that for his basic wants and needs, but just in a conversational way. So if you sit down and you have a conversation about the basketball tournament, then put some pictures together or some words together that would allow him to have a conversation about the basketball tournament that you just discussed. And that's where you put the language ladder in that you can download. That's very predictable, okay? So you have to ask better questions oftentimes. You want to work on turn-taking. There's not really that much turn-taking in basic wants and needs. You just say what you want, and then people give it to you.
Right, but then finding other things that they like. For example, you were talking about basketball. If someone's really into basketball,
mm-hmm.
or someone's obsessed with violins, whatever
right.
it is that person is into would be a good starting place for
right.
communication that doesn't specifically have to do with wants and needs.
Right, and so oftentimes I'll say, well, what do you guys do as a family? You know, how do you spend your time? Or what does he like to watch on TV? Or when does he hang out when you're watching TV? You know, he always hangs out when the Discovery Channel's on. Okay, does he like it when the animals are on, or does he like it when the ocean light's on, or does he like it when the technology part's on? Oh, he really likes the ocean life. Okay, so I'm going to probe in the ocean life area. Now, that's not anything that he's practiced, but I'm going to create a board as I'm talking to him with pictures or words or whatever the symbol is that I've assessed he can do, and I'm going to throw it out there. I'm going to ask a better question, and I'm going to probe a little bit. If he says, oh, let's say he identifies shark, and he identifies whale, and he identifies coral, then I might say, okay, well, which one of these would you find in a reef? And then he points to the coral. Yeah, the coral, that usually grows on a reef, you're right. So I'm trying to kind of simulate a real conversation other than a basic wants and needs conversation.
Right.
We ask too many questions, and then we say, oh, he just labels things or just gives basic wants and needs. We
right.
need to give comments. We need to give feedback. We need to acknowledge the communication.
Yeah, good points. Okay, back to some questions here. Yvonne Mattson from Mount Pleasant. We're working with an 8-year-old student diagnosed with infantile autism. He has no way to communicate. He can say ma and pee and sign chips and movie. He has never learned sign language or used an augmentative device. The schools have been using ABA, but apparently not correctly. Because he cannot communicate in any way, he now bites, scratches, and runs. What would you suggest would be the best way to assist him in learning how to communicate?
Okay, well, that kind of opens up the door because I think there were a number of questions on sign language. And I just wanted to put my...
Language and also on behaviors, so that's two issues.
Yeah. Well, I'll go to the sign language first because that's easier. Like when I gave the symbol hierarchy, sign language is up in the area of speech. It doesn't take quite as much coordination as speech, but it does take a great deal of coordination. So if your person's not doing too well with sign language, then I would move on to some visual-based system like pictures and stuff that don't require a lot of fine motor activity. A lot of times we'll get the kids at a young age doing some basic signs, but then if it doesn't become communicative, if we don't transition it to communication, and we just keep it at the basic wants and needs level because that's what their motor system can handle, first of all, it becomes individualized, so they have their own version that most people are going to have to learn just as much as they would have to learn their vocalization, approximation. And then the other thing is that sometimes you'll just start getting that into the automatic, and you'll just get all the signs back to say, I have a want. So the I have a want sign becomes bathroom, good boy, and eat. And you give all those signs. And so we really it's still a motor act. And so you have to think of it as, how am I teaching this motorically? And I have to generalize from the automatic, I can do those signs, to the voluntary. Doesn't mean it can't happen, but it might not be the most efficient way to spend your time, especially early on. You always have to decide what you're going to focus on based on how much time you have and what your current level of communication is. Okay? As far as the behaviors go, you're going to get more behaviors if you don't have communication yet. Doesn't mean that all behaviors are communicative. Some are sensory or regulating. But for sure, if you don't have communication, you're going to have behaviors, unless you have a guy that doesn't initiate anything, I guess. So you want to have communication happening, not at the level of speech, for example. If they can't do speech, then do something augmentative, because otherwise you're going to get behaviors. And so if in your ABA program the golden objectives are inappropriate for the development of speech for your person, which I don't know if they are or not, but if you didn't have a speech person, they could be, then you're going to have a guy who's struggling to get his speech organized and still has no mode of communication. And that's going to equal behaviors.
Okay. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. All right, now I was just thinking about what you said, but I thought that I'd lost you and I didn't hear anything anymore.
I was waiting for your words.
Okay. Very good. Can we go on to some more questions? You ready for some more?
Sure.
Okay, here's Monique Manuel Tucson. She's from Tucson. Talking about muscle tone and reading comprehension, I just heard about weighted belts. Do you have experience with that or know if it might work? I have a high-functioning autistic 9-year-old third grade. It sounded like it might help keep a connection with his brain and muscles keeping his brain going.
And so is she asking if he should wear a weighted belt?
Yeah, I guess she wants to know your opinion about weighted belts and how that might help with keeping somebody grounded.
Well, first of all, you got to use those kinds of strategies with the assistance of an occupational therapist.
Right.
So I'm not an occupational therapist, but I'm on teams with a lot of occupational therapists, and we do use the weighted vests or the weighted blankets for support to stay seated and keep that tone down, you know, in the trunk area. So, yeah, that can help. Again, if the weight isn't for developing, you know, muscle men, it's for developing proprioceptive input.
Right.
So you really want to do that with the assistance of a occupational therapist. But sometimes those bumpy cushions, those can help a person keep their tone in their hips and things so that they can stay seated better. And again, the weighted blankets or something on their lap can be helpful as well. Or the weighted vest can be helpful. But do that under the guidance of your occupational therapist.
Yes. Occupational therapists work really well hand-in-hand with speech therapists. I mean, when you have a team where they're working hand-in-hand, it's so much better for the child.
Absolutely.
Okay, so many questions here. Let's see. Nancy Riley from West Melbourne. Once you begin finding out what your child knows, do you have any suggestions on how to determine the educational holes and how to fill them in?
Well, that can be a tough one because, you know, if you're assuming that your person possibly learned by being around situations like your verbal kids would do that, then, and your person has led a active life with you, supporting him even though he didn't speak, they could be having a whole bunch of information in their heads that it would be very hard to assess all of the information. So you kind of have to take a stab in the dark, I think. I mean, there's no test you can give that would, especially if you have to give support. If you have to give the physical support, then it's not a standardized test anymore, so that's not going to fly. But if you're using, I just tend to use grade level material and grade level testing if I'm going to do a test to see, and then I just say this isn't standardized because I had to organize it in a different way than it was meant to do, but I can at least get kind of a feel for what level of understanding he has, especially in reading comprehension and in math. And once you do that, then just you have to just start working forward. And especially math, you know, if you get to an area and he keeps missing a lot or doesn't seem to grasp it, then that's where you start teaching. It's, again, it's just about getting to the point where you ask better questions. And when you ask somebody if they know what you were just talking about right now and they can answer you, then that's what you know. You know they can answer your questions when you're talking to them. So now you want to know how much information he has in his head. Well, if he's 23, that could be a lot of information. You know, if he's 8, that could be just, you know, a decent amount of information. But there's no real test to give it, unfortunately, because it would make life easier. But it's just start doing it. Start learning. Most people with autism are learners. That's what they do best is learn information. It's just they can't express it. I mean, most people that I know.
If this person doesn't have the help of a teacher, much like I didn't at the beginning with Jeremy, really, I know I keep talking about these Summer Bridges books.
Yeah, they were great.
I found a few things on the internet, but not very many, because a lot of the things were teacher-specific, and my brain just didn't function that way. And also, when you're doing such an enormous task, or it seems like it's an enormous task, you want to make it fun, and you want to make it something that you feel that you're accomplishing, as well as figuring out what your child knows or doesn't know. And those Summer Bridges books were really good because they were easy enough for me to handle. And I just bought a whole bunch of different years' worth.
Yes.
And I just started going through them, and I skipped around some. And, of course, I avoided all the topics I hated to do to begin with. I decided to make it fun for both of us. And if it wasn't going to be fun for me, then it certainly wasn't going to be fun for Jeremy. And then I started having a real idea of where he was in certain things. And then luckily, when he got to the high school and the school got interested, then there was a teacher who came on who was really great, and he managed then to do all the curriculum-type tests.
Right.
So they did a great assessment on what areas Jeremy hadn't learned and where he was in all his different subjects. So because I had insisted on Jeremy being mainstreamed for part of his day, even if we had no idea whether he was learning anything or not, because I got it in there since I couldn't really use it as an academic goal, I just used it as a social goal, because I figured everyone has to learn and sit. You know, I want to take him to the movies, he's got to learn and sit.
Yeah.
Learn to sit. And listen. So it turns out that all those years he was listening, because a lot of the classes that he sat in on, he was actually learning the information when he was in junior high.
Right.
And that reminds me, I don't have my finger on the question right now, but there were at least two or three questions about inclusion, or how much time you think that students with autism who do not have much language should be spending in general education or general community, out in the community. In other words, with non-special education people.
Right. Okay, a couple of things. I wrote down everything you're talking about so I can go through it all, but there's some websites that can be helpful for downloading information if you don't have access to the teaching supply stores. And I think that if you do have access to teaching supply stores, or even if your local general store kind of has some educational material, this is a good time of year in the United States, anyways, to do that, because it's summertime, and so they're stocking up on those bridge kind of materials. In anticipation that families are going to want to keep things going, okay? So they don't carry that all year round. They usually carry that at this time of year. So so that's a really good thing to do. A couple of websites would be, the ones that I use a lot are enchantedlearning.com. And so that's enchantedlearning.com. And another one that I like is called Ed Helper, E-D as in Darlene, helper.com. And both of those sites, if it's a really minimal fee to join and get things printed so you can print them out. But you can print out a lot of materials, and you can, an Ed Helper, you can design, you know, I want it to be multiple choice, I want it to be expressive language, what do I want it to do, and grade levels and things like that. Another one that we've been hanging with and doing a lot with is called Bookshare, just like Bookshare.com. And if you go on their website, then you can get some books that will be downloadable to your computer, and that can help out. And then another thing that we're that people are exploring is the online courses. And so I have a few families that have signed up for online courses. Whether or not their kids go to school or not, some don't go to school, and so that's what they use. Other kids go to school and do more functional programs, but the family wants them to work on more academics, and so they're signing up for the online courses. And that's usually a pretty good format for our guys, you know, if we can, again, get them communicating, which brings me to the inclusion question. I did, I was a program specialist for full inclusion for 8 years, and when it was successful, whether it be integration or full inclusion, was when the person had a means to communicate and participate. So, and because I believe that we can figure things out for most people, I think we need to spend time looking at that in a healthy way. So if the number of hours that you're thinking of means he doesn't, your person doesn't have any time with the specialists to figure out their mode of communication, and they don't have a mode of communication to participate in the curriculum, I would say decrease your integration or your inclusion time so that that can be another tandem focus. The reality is that your general education teacher and your instructional aide is probably not going to figure out how your tricky person who communicates when he's nonverbal. That's not their expertise. So if you need to go and spend some time and cut some time out of that inclusion time so that you can figure out a productive means of communication for your individual, that's going to be better. Because as soon as you get that, then go back to the full inclusion piece. But now he's ready to participate. Otherwise, you're going to max out, and it's going to end up that he's either doing his own curriculum in the back of the room, and he's just hanging out with some general ed kids, or he's going to have behaviors because he's bored, because he doesn't get to participate in most of the curriculum. So, you know, you kind of it's a personal decision for everybody, but my thing is that if you don't have time to figure out his communication system, and you don't have a communication system so that that teacher can know that he's getting information that she's teaching, it's going to end up failing at some point in the courses, because that's what teachers want to know. They want to know that they taught you something, and that's their job. So you have to really kind of make those decisions based on where you are and where your child is and what's your real goal. Because you only have so many educational hours in a day. And
that's
you
right.
want to use your specialist in the right way.
And it is an individual thing.
Absolutely.
It's not one answer that's going to be right for everybody.
You might be having behaviors in a class because your child doesn't have a mode of communication and he's sitting there bored, or he's sitting there frustrated because he actually knows those answers.
Right.
And he has to sit and write his name over and over again when he would love to be talking about the Westward Movement.
You know, it's really hard for parents because we really need to look at the difference between what we want and what it is that's right for the child. So, for example, in my mind, because my first job I ever had out of college was working at a state hospital for the developmentally disabled, and my whole job there for 2 years was teaching these young adults the skills they needed to live in a group home. In other words, I was a big community person. You know, everyone should be out in the community. Everyone should be out mainstreamed or included. Then I had Jeremy, and when Jeremy was little, I always thought, well, you know, first of all, he's going to grow out of this, not grow out, but, you know, I'm going to teach him, and I'm going to do everything, and he's going to learn quickly, and he's never going to be like one of those guys at Fairview State Hospital. Well, what do I have now is I have someone who's a lot like the guys at Fairview State Hospital, except that he has a way to communicate,
right,
which is the biggest difference in his life. But I knew when he was younger in grammar school, there's no way he could sit all day in a mainstream class. It was too painful for him,
mm-hmm.
for his hearing. Like, kids shriek when they're little. They have
right.
this high-pitched voice that drove him crazy. And he needed the sensory integration. He needed speech. And he just was not happy sitting all the time in these mainstream classes. So me as a parent and as a professional was like, full inclusion, that's what's going to work for my son. That's what we're going to have. And I right away I saw, you know, this is right for some kids, it's not right for my kid.
And it's not right right now. It doesn't mean it's not right ever.
Correct.
You know, you're showing full inclusion and general education at any of the grade levels.
Exactly.
And so, again, there's not that window of opportunity. Now, are you going to play catch-up? Probably so in some areas.
Yeah.
But maybe not as much as you thought you would. Because if you can figure out that your guy's a learner, then people are just going to teach him. And he's going to say he's got it.
Yeah, and that's why the American IEPs every year, because you can change your plans.
Exactly.
And, you know, as a parent, you have to learn to be, proactive or an advocate in that area and not feel bullied. But you really have to remember that everything can change from year to year. So you can't get stuck thinking one way.
And Chantal, that kind of reminds me of one other thing that I should probably bring up, and that's when do you bring in the functional curriculum?
Oh, okay.
And when do you give up on the academic curriculum? Because that's a big question that comes to families.
Especially middle school.
Yes, middle school starts switching over. And I understand the need for functional curriculum. That's a good thing. I mean, I've worked in a community-based program, in a transition program, and those are all great skills for people to work on. I don't believe, personally, that the elementary kids need to start learning because they're not going to learn fast enough to be done learning by the time they're 22, to vacuum the house, for example. You know? So if you're an elementary student and the community is your campus, it's not street crossing. I never let my kids cross the street on their own when they're in elementary school. My kids don't have a disability or an IEP because that's not what we do. So it's a functional skill, but it's not, you don't have to start teaching it because it's going to take so long to teach them how to cross the street. The other thing is that I know a lot of people who are adults now who still don't have functional skills that allow them to be independent. But if they can communicate, then they can direct their staff. And part of their communication to direct their staff is through their critical thinking. If they still have behavioral challenges, we need them to explain what's going on with them. You know, am I sick? Am I obsessed? Can I not switch my thinking? Do I hate that guy? What's the deal? We need them to tell us what that is. And then we need them to help us with the process of how are we going to fix this with you? How are we going to support this with you? And that comes through learning critical thinking. And critical thinking is not part of our functional curriculum 90% of the time. Of course,
problem solving, a lot of times we're not teaching problem solving. Every time that I go out, people talk to me about executive functioning, but they only talk about it for people with Asperger's.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, executive functioning can be taught to anybody on the spectrum. It's just at a different level and in different ways.
Well, if you don't have good predictability skills, which is a common theme with people with autism, right, and you're nonverbal, you still don't have good predictability skills, okay? So if we don't develop that through your theory of mind and your critical thinking and your executive functions, all that kind of higher-level stuff, then you're going to be a person that responds to the here and now because you still didn't learn to develop any predictability.
Right.
That's a problem for our adults. And so if we don't teach that, and again, you need communication to get that part across, but start working on communication early on or bring it in if they're older and quickly bring in problem solving, because that's what helps us be better support people. So in California, we have a big conference called the Supported Life Institute. And one year they had it was all on augmented communication, and there was a whole lot of people using augmented communication devices and the person had cerebral palsy or some kind of other motor disability, not necessarily autism. And as I was watching, I thought about the fact that and these people ran businesses, and they worked in the government, okay, but very involved motorically. And I thought, you know, if we didn't have a communication device for every single one of those persons, he would look like the guys who live in Fairview State Hospital in the developmentally handicapped institutional kind of settings. Mm-hmm. Because it's his mode of communication that allows him to say who he is and to look smart.
Mm-hmm.
So there's tons of having expressive language and communication is functional. And if you have to keep developing it so that you can be the director of your life, then that's a functional skill.
Yeah, I mean, it's like people who need a wheelchair. Some people may always need a support person. I mean, you hope that they wouldn't, just like you always try and get out of a wheelchair. You know, it's
right.
But it's
sometimes
what you need.
Gonna be.
What you need.
Right. And so I'd rather have a bunch of people who can communicate with us, who are dependent on others, doing just that, than a bunch of people who can't communicate with us very well and only can say that they have to go to the bathroom and that they want to go to McDonald's for a hamburger.
And also there's other ways that they can contribute to society. For example, even my son right now in workability, he helped the other students put together a business plan and marketing for a coffee cart. So now they're making money from this coffee cart. And Jeremy's not very good at actually making the coffee because of all his motor skill issues, but he's very good at figuring out how much things cost, where they should go buy things, how do you do the marketing, all that kind of stuff. So it's still an important part of anything in the community to be able to do those kind of thinking things.
Right. A lot of times for a lot of these people, especially people who end up with literacy skills and end up doing, you know, great thinking and writing projects, what we look at as traditional vocational opportunities for people with disabilities is the most challenging for them. So, you know, they're more likely to be a writer. They're more likely to be a program designer of some sort, like Jeremy is doing with his coffee cart. They're more likely to be advocates than they are to ever get good at wiping down tables.
Right. Okay, back to a couple more questions because we have about 9 minutes left.
Okay.
Okay, so there is a question from Satish in Bhopal, India, and it's really, there was a long explanation of where this child is at. Sounds like his parents have done really a lot with supporting him to learn as much as he can. So I'm just going to go down to the actual question that he has or that she has. Though the boy is still nonverbal, now he can communicate all his needs well through signs and gestures and follow our instructions and requests quite well. Nowadays we are working with Manu, that's his name, on a home-based program. Structured education is planned and suggested. Along with this, we are trying inclusion of peer-age regular children for in- and outdoor activities. Manu is doing very nice in math in many more areas. My question is that how Manu's communication skill can be improved. Is it right to use PECS or sign language, or which one would be more effective? And let me see if he says somewhere how old he is. Oh, his date of birth is October 2000. So
just 7. Right? 7 years old?
Well,
almost.
It's the year 2000, so.
Oh, 2000.
And now we're 2009.
Yeah, 9. Okay. I thought you said 2002. I'm
okay, so we need to go to math school.
My auditory system is getting overwhelmed. Okay, so I think that, you know, again, signs, my preference is to not focus on that if it doesn't come easily, because my focus is that he has augmentative communication. So if he doesn't have speech. So I would not feel bad at all about continuing to develop a visual language. So then I would go to, okay, what's the symbol that he understands? Is it photos? Is it line drawings? Is it words? Don't be afraid to ask. Maybe he can identify words. If he can, you can do a lot with, you don't have to go, oh, I have to look up that picture. You just write down the word as you're talking, and then he can communicate. So that would be my choice and my recommendation in that kind of a situation. If he can develop sign language for basic wants and needs and continue to develop a sign vocabulary, that's great. And some of it might be gestural, that's great. But he's not going to probably keep up with curriculum with the sign language if he's been taught it and
still has a small vocabulary, which I'm assuming that is the case. And then as far as, I think she was asking about the integration with the regular ed or the general ed kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it depends on the behaviors, of course. And so if being around a whole bunch of other kids makes him stressed out or overloads his sensory system, then you're going to have to do that systematically. But if he can handle that, then that's a good thing. He's probably going to need some support to do that. And so he might, you know, if you had a classroom, for example, of 20, he might do better with a group of two. But,
right.
But that's okay, because he's a little guy, and you can set up those kind of situations for him. But you got to focus on the turn-taking and the socializing while you're doing that, because otherwise you just end up with a bunch of smart guys that can sit in class halfway decently but don't interact with anyone.
Right. There's somebody who asked here about if you were familiar with the new program. It's Pam from Maggie in Mississippi. Are you familiar with the program called ProLoco2Go, an application for iTouch iPhone? If so, is it a good program?
Right. The ProLoco2Go, which I guess I should spell, but I have to write it first. ProLoco.
I can spell it. I can spell it because it's here. P
okay,
as in Paul, R as in Rebecca, O, L as in Lisa, O, Q, U, O, the number 2, and go.
Okay. So the ProLoco2Go is a application that you can purchase through iTunes and download onto your iPhone or your iPod Touch. You would want to have a speaker system on it. So, like, I have an old version of the iPod Touch, so I have the external speaker set up, which is a nice little box that you can get to go with it, and so you can hear what's being said. I think on the new iPod Touch they have a speaker, but I don't know how loud it could go. I think I still would recommend an external speaker box. But it's like a zipper case and everything's self-contained. And you can actually purchase the whole setup, the iPod, the software, and the zippered speaker system from the people selling the ProLoco2Go. So you could check their website or just Google that ProLoco2Go and you'll find them easily. But it's an application. It's under $200 as far as an application goes, which is really nice because you the similar kind of system would cost about $3,500 if you bought a communication device. So the price is great. It's still got some glitches. It's brand new, just came out in April. But in theory, it's pretty cool, and it's got some – it's all set up already to say different things. So you can use what they have set it up to do, or you can customize it and add and subtract, and you can put pictures in there and do all kinds of fun stuff that way. Now,
yeah, for those who don't know what it is, and I know we have to stop in 2 minutes, it does have pictures just like icons, and it also has words that you can type.
Right, and it also has a keyboard. Now,
the
thing is, you have to realize it's an iPod Touch, so it's very small. So if your person can't access a small device, then that's not going to be good for you. But if your person can, and you have the or want to get those pieces, you know, the iPod Touch or the iPhone, then it'd be great to have it around, you know, for your person to communicate. And I think that as they create, they fix some of the glitches, I'm sure they're going to have it where you can upgrade, you know, as far as they kind of revise things. And then you, when you get into iTunes, it'll say you got to upgrade your system, and they'll let you do that, I would guess. But it's a nice little thing to explore if you have the funds and the need. Again, it's a small thing because it's an iPod Touch.
Right. Well, that's all the time that we have, Darlene. I want to thank you again for being our guest tonight.
Thank you.
Darlene Hansen, speech and language pathologist, and her website is www.darlenehansen, which is darlenehanson.com. Thank you, Darlene.
Thank you.
And it's been Chantal Cecile Kira moderating, and you've been listening to MomsFightingAutism.com. Hope you're back again next month. And meanwhile, be the change that you want to see. Thank you.